fast, slow, randomly, like Morse code. Up ahead, the big truck slowed. Behind it, the dust cloud caught up momentarily and then thinned out and fell away. The truck stopped 300 yards west, in the middle of the road itself, like a long-distance showdown.
"More than one person," Reacher said. "They can't agree what to do. They stopped to talk it out."
They waited. Up ahead, the truck moved forward, slowly, like cruising a parking lot. It rolled on, 200 yards away, 150 yards away. It was the same crew cab they had seen the night before. Huge size, a rumbling exhaust, 3 people in it, the same guys. Reacher was sure of it. They came to a stop, 50 feet away. Bramall turned off his hazard lights. For a second, the tableau was frozen. 2 trucks facing off, close together, engines idling, on a narrow red ribbon in the middle of a vast version of nowhere. Mackenzie got out of the Toyota. Bramall moved to do the same, but Reacher put a hand on his shoulder.
"We need to talk," he said. "About what?"
"Your client. She's got a tough day ahead."
"You know what's going to happen?"
"Unfortunately," Reacher said, "it's the only thing that fits." But Mackenzie was already turned around, miming impatience, so Bramall slid out to join her, followed by Reacher, 3 steps behind. From the crew cab came the guy with the lizard boots and his 2 companions. 6 people altogether, in 2 groups of 3, all of them eyeing the no-man's land between their radiator grills, their postures subject to ancient instincts. They met in the middle, 5 polite feet apart, safely longer than a dagger's thrust. Another ancient instinct. The guy in the boots said,
"The message hasn't changed."
"I thought about that," Reacher said.
"Seemed to me, if you boiled it right down, the main takeaway from the message was we should go back where we came from, which makes it more of a suggestion, don't you think? Call it a request to assume good manners on your part, and, hey, plenty of requests are perfectly reasonable. We all know that. I would like to request $1 million and a dinner date with Miss Wyoming. But the point of a request is that it can be declined. Respectfully, with great regret, and so on, but declined nonetheless, which is what is happening here."
"Unacceptable."
"Get used to it. We're going to stick around, and if any of the actual landowners out here have a problem with it, I'm sure the state has laws that would allow them to seek a remedy." The guy said,
"Right now, we're being nice about it."
"My advice? You should keep on being nice about it. Even if we lose, we'll do some damage. 2 of you will go to the hospital, best case. But from what I've seen, I have to say, the best case looks unlikely. I don't think we'll lose. I think all 3 of you will go to the hospital." The guy paused a beat. Then he said,
"Okay." It was a request.
Reacher said, "I'm glad we got that cleared up."
"There's nothing for you here."
"Who made the request?"
"I'm not going to tell you. This whole thing is about privacy. You don't get it, do you?"
Reacher said, "You got a phone?"
"Who do you want to call?"
"Take a picture. Video would be better. You got video on your phone?" The guy said,
"I guess."
"All we'll do is say our names, maybe add a line of background, on your phone. Then you can take it back and show it to whoever it was who made the request. That would be fair to all concerned."
"You might follow us there."
"We promise we won't."
"Why would we trust you?"
"You live in there somewhere, we know that. By now it's a 1 in 5 chance. We'll find you sooner or later. It's only a matter of time."
The guy didn't answer.
"But I'd rather do it this way," Reacher said. This way is better. The guy didn't answer, but eventually he nodded. One of the back row guys stepped up with a phone. He held it horizontal between splayed fingers and crossed his eyes and said,
Go.
Mackenzie said,
Jane Mackenzie.
Brammel said,
Terry Brammel, private detective from Chicago.
Reacher said,
Jack Reacher, ex-army, once upon a time CEO of the 110th MP.
The back row guy lowered the phone. Reacher said,
We'll wait here.
Could be a couple hours,
the guy with the boots said.
You got water?
The other back row guy carried bottles of water from their truck to the Toyota. Then they backed up and turned around and drove away. The dust cloud picked up behind them, turning, rising, falling, hanging in the air like evidence, showing the way they had gone like a whoosh in a cartoon strip. Brammel said,
Do we follow?
No, Reacher said.
A professional courtesy. Not required, but expected. Mackenzie said,
You know, don't you?
I know two things, Reacher said. She lives here, and no one recognizes you.
Chapter 32 Brammel backed up to where the rock ledge petered out and the ditch filled in. He parked on the shoulder, a little tilted, facing west. Reacher drank a bottle of donated water and walked back to the ledge and sat in the sun. The last of summer. No one talked. Mostly, Brammel sat in the car, nothing on his face, a man life had taught to be patient. Mostly, Mackenzie stood alone, as far from the car as Reacher, but in the other direction. High overhead, ravens circled and looked and thought, not yet, and soared away. In the end, it was less than 2 hours. It was 93 minutes, which was an hour and a half, and change. Far in the distance, a smudge of dust kicked up, with a black dot in front of it, which grew larger until they could see who it was. It was the three guys in their crew cab, back again. Like before, they stopped 50 feet out, and they climbed down and they walked forward. Reacher and Brammel and Mackenzie went to meet them. They all stopped. 6 people, groups of 3, 5 polite feet apart. The guy in the boots said,
Just Mrs. Mackenzie.
Reacher waited. Mackenzie said,
No, all 3 of us.
The guy said nothing. Reacher waited again for their plan B. He knew they had one. Stupid to come without. The guy said,
Okay.
He turned and walked back, and the 3 of them climbed in their crew cab again. Brammel and Mackenzie and Reacher climbed in the Toyota. The crew cab backed up and turned and drove away west. Brammel followed, hanging back, drifting left, drifting right, trying to miss the worst of the dust. The crew cab turned in on the 2nd track on the right. Brammel followed. The track was wide, but the surface was bad. Roots, rocks, gravel. Up ahead, the crew cab bucked and bounced. Its tires chirped and slid on stones worn smooth by time. There were trees left and right, mostly conifers, some gnarled by the wind, some stately. There were distant blazes of gold, mostly in the gulches and the gullies where the aspen was happiest. The track went left and right, around trees, around rocks the size of cars, some of them piled high on top of each other, some of them overhanging. After more than 4 slow miles, the track came to a building. It was made of logs and looked like a vacation cabin. Livable, but not for long, not a permanent home. Dusty windows, unoccupied, maybe abandoned. The crew cab didn't stop. It churned on by, all four wheels working, and half a mile later it passed another cabin just the same. Dusty windows, unoccupied, maybe abandoned. Reacher figured they were in a compound, laid out like an old-fashioned vacation camp, with isolated accommodations in separate woodland clearings, all connected together by winding tracks like the one they were on, which in theory might sooner or later lead to some kind of central destination. It did. The track came around the base of a wooded slope and opened up on what looked at first like empty blue sky, but turned out to be a small plateau on the low slopes of a mountain with infinite views north and east. There was a sprawling log house made of massive timbers, not a commercial enterprise, not an office or a camp clubhouse, just the main family home. Maybe the cabins have been for their guests, or for children and grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, some kind of patriarch's dream. Maybe the owner had been a big man in the county. The crew cab didn't stop. They followed it onward, away from the big house, along another winding track, around a long, artful curve through the trees, and then another in the other direction, and finally they came out in another clearing, which had a cabin set high on a rock foundation at the head of a small fissure or ravine, which crumbled away in a southwesterly direction, and which thinned the trees enough to show a narrow view of the empty plains and the distant horizon. From the front porch, the magic hour before sunset would be spectacular. The house itself was made of logs, neat and plain, like a child's drawing, with a door in the middle and a window on the left and a window on the right, with a green metal roof and a chimney. Civilized, Reacher thought. Reasonably big. Not up a tree. Plus far from anywhere. Comfortably concealed, as secret as could be, but with a view from the porch. Why give it up? Next to the house was a barn, with an open door. Parked in the barn was an old SUV, an ancient model, boxy and battered and square, covered with rust and red dust so thick it looked baked on. Up ahead, the crew cab stopped. Bramall stopped. The guy with the boots got out. He walked around to the Toyota's front passenger door, and he pulled it open. He said, "Mrs. McKenzie, first." She got out. The guy led her down a beaten earth path and up the porch steps to the door. He knocked, and she waited. A small figure, her face set, her hair tumbling everywhere. The guy got a response from inside, and he opened the door and held it, like a bellboy in a hotel. Mackenzie stood still for a second, and then she walked past him and into the house. The guy closed the door after her and came down off the porch and walked back to his truck. No sound, no movement.
"Russ Anderson is in there?"
Bramall said.
"Yes," Reacher said.
"You know this because you know two things."
"Three altogether," Reacher said. "I didn't mention the extra one."
"You know Rose lives here, and you know no one in town recognizes her sister."
"And I know she won a Purple Heart."
Bramall was quiet a long moment.
"It was a facial wound," he said.
Reacher nodded. "Had to be," he said.
"How bad?"
"Bad enough that no one recognizes her sister. Bad enough she hides all the time. Bad enough she turns her face away. Bad enough she holds up in the bedroom when the roofer works inside."
Bramall sat in the car, but Reacher was stiff from sitting. He got out to take a stroll, to loosen up, like he had at the comfort stop in Wisconsin. He took the ring out of his pocket, the gold filigree, the black stone, the tiny size, SRS 2005. Against the vast wilderness all around, it looked impossibly delicate and intricate and finely wrought. He walked to the lip of the ravine and looked at the view. He could see 50 miles, a slice of Colorado, but mostly Wyoming. Thin, clear air, immense tawny plains, spiky trees, rocky outcrops, hazy mountains. Nothing moving. He felt all alone on an empty planet. He could imagine hiding out there, seeing no one, no one seeing him. Nowhere better. She might not want to be found. He turned away and walked up to the garage and took a look at the old SUV. It was an ancient Ford Bronco, the same make and model he rode in from Casper to Laramie, with the guy who turned logs into sculptures with chainsaws. That had been a basic vehicle, but Rose Sanderson's was plainer still. It was scoured back to bare metal by wind and sand. The metal looked like it had returned to some kind of primitive ore. It was scabbed and pitted and dented here and there by minor collisions. No panel was straight. The tires were worn. The front end smelled of gasoline. He walked back to the Toyota. By that point, Mackenzie had been in the house an hour. Bramall had his window down, for the air, presumably. Thin and clear, warm in the sun, cold in the shadows. Bramall said,
"One of those days."
"I woke up knowing," Reacher said.
"A hands-on client is always a problem. I could have prepared her. I could have cleaned things up a bit."
"I suppose your job is done now. Don't leave without me. I need a ride back to town."
"After you give her the ring."
"Not important anymore. Not in the scheme of things. Mrs. Mackenzie can pass it on."
"I won't leave right away," Bramall said. "Partly because I think Mrs. Mackenzie is about to request an extension to my contract. She's going to need some kind of help. If not from me, then at least she'll expect a ride to the hotel or the airport."
"Does your phone work from here?"
"Two bars, if you face the ravine."
"Which the house does. She could have called from here. When she said, 'Shut up, Si, I'm on the phone,' it was either here or Porterfield's place. Had to be one or the other."
"You plan on asking her much about Porterfield?"
"I'm with the majority here. The thing with the bear is most likely bullshit." "That plan has changed because of the hands-on client. The story skipped straight to the big reunion. Rose won't talk to us now. It won't occur to her."
"Why would it?
When your long-lost twin sister shows up at your door, you don't necessarily invite the cab driver in the house. You don't make small talk."
"You wanted to know the story."
"I got most of it," Reacher said. "I got to the part where it ends about 20 miles before the road runs out." 20 minutes later, the front door opened and Mackenzie stepped out on the porch. She turned and closed the door. She stood still, more than a minute, visibly breathing deep and slow in and out. Then she stepped down on the scrub path. She started walking. Bramall and Reacher got out of the car to meet her. She had been crying, that was clear. At first she said nothing. It was as if she had lost the power of speech. Her lips moved and she made sounds, but no words came out.
"Take it easy," Bramall said.
She took a breath. She said,
"My sister would like to speak with Mr. Reacher now."
Reacher looked at her, first in surprise, then as if about to ask a question, which he didn't, because what could he say? "Is she a mess? Was it worse than you expected?" She looked back at him, defeated, and she half shrugged and half nodded, as if saying yes and no to everything. He walked down the scrub path and stepped up on the porch. Chapter 33. Richard turned the knob and opened the door and stepped inside. He realized in his mind he was expecting some kind of an elaborate Gothic vision, involving shrouded windows and darkness, with maybe a lone candle burning somewhere and a vague figure talking softly behind a heavy veil. The reality was a bright, sun-filled house made of shiny logs the color of wildflower honey. The front door opened directly into the living room. It was small and neat and clean, but mostly empty. Nothing in it but two large armchairs placed on either side of the fireplace at comfortable and companionable angles. Rose Sanderson was in the left-hand chair. Below the neck, she was her sister's double. No mistake. She sat in a chair the exact same way. Her resting posture was identical. The angle of her wrist, the spread of her fingers, the tilt of her waist. A replica. Above the neck? Not so much. Not anymore. She was wearing a silver tracksuit top with a tight hood, which was pulled up around her head. She had tightened the drawstring in front until only an oval of face was showing. On the left was a web of scar tissue, random and uneven, and on the right was a sheet of aluminum foil, oozing with some kind of thick ointment. She had pressed the foil to the shape of her head, like half a mask, a silvery color. She wasn't sweating. She wasn't trembling. Her eyes looked okay. Better than okay. Her eyes were the eyes of a person who felt deeply serene and contented. She said,
"I want to ask you about something my sister said."
Her voice was the same. Same note, same pitch, same volume. Richard shook her hand and sat down in the empty chair. Up close, he could see the left-hand part of her face was somehow reconstructed. It was stitched together from small fragments. The right-hand part was hidden under the homemade tinfoil poultice. He said, "What do you want to ask me?"
"My sister says you found my class ring in a pawn shop."
"I did."
"Therefore, your involvement here was completely accidental."
"It was."
"But it strikes me you would say that anyway, whether or not it was true. And it strikes me my sister is the type of person who might believe it."
"Where else would I find your ring?"
"A police evidence locker, maybe."
"Who do you think I am, really?"
"Maybe still the 110th MP.
"That was a long time ago."
"Then why did you mention it on the video?"
"So you would know I wasn't bullshitting about being in the army. No one would claim the 110th if they didn't have to." She nodded inside her hood. The foil on her face rustled and clicked. Reacher said, "Are you expecting a visit from the 110th MP?
"Not specifically," she said. "Maybe someone like that."
"Why?"
"A number of things."
"Not me," Reacher said. "I'm just a guy passing through. Nothing more."
"You sure?"
"Promise." She nodded again, as if the matter was settled. He took the ring from his pocket one last time, and he handed it over. She rolled it in her palm and looked at it from every direction. She smiled. The foil clicked, and a jagged, hollow crease appeared in her left cheek, as if the structure of her face had collapsed, maybe a weak suture. She said,
"Thank you."
He said, "You're welcome." She said,
"I honestly thought I would never see it again."
Then she gave it back.
"I would owe you $40, she said. "Haven't got it right now."
"It's a gift," he said.
"Then I accept. Thank you. But not now. Would you hold it for me? Just a month or so. I could call when I'm ready.
You're worried you'll trade it away again.
Just recently, everything has gotten so damn expensive.
Must be difficult making ends meet.
It is.
Is that why you're worried about meeting someone like the 110th MP? She shook her head.
I'm not worried about what I do, she said. No one is interested in my situation. They've given up on people like me.
Then why expect a visit?
Something different. I had a friend whose case is still open. Back burner, I'm sure. But some work must get done. One day they'll have enough.
For what?
To take another look, I suppose. My working assumption is one day they'll send a guy. For a moment I hoped you were him, equipped with my ring as a stage prop. But apparently you're not him. That's okay. I just wanted to check. Would you ask my sister to come by again?
Mackenzie was in the front seat of the Toyota. Her skin was pale. Her flawless face looked hyper-vivid, impossibly smooth, impossibly perfect. Reacher told her Rose wanted to see her again. She looked a question at him. He didn't know what she was asking. Maybe she was looking for some kind of general agreement that could have been worse. Some kind of optimistic thinking. Or not, he couldn't tell. He made an all-purpose, don't-know expression, and she nodded as if she understood. She got out of the car and walked up the path to the house. She went inside again. She closed the door. Reacher took her place in the car. He closed the door. Grandma said,
"How was it?"
"Pretty bad," he said. "It hasn't healed."
"What state was she in?"
"High as a kite."
"And what?"
"Something she claims has just gotten very expensive. I guess she's still holding out for the good stuff. She's not in the toilet stall yet."
"Agent Noble implied she would have to be by now. He claims he tracks every shipment."
"Maybe he was out sick the day they taught real life. Nothing works 100%.
"What did she want to speak with you about?"
"She's expecting some kind of investigator to show up one day, asking questions about Porterfield. She was disappointed I wasn't him. She thinks it's still an open case." Grandma didn't reply. Reacher asked him, "What did Mrs. Mackenzie have to say?"
"Nothing good."
"I woke up knowing."
"Rose Sanderson got hit in the face by 5 pieces of shrapnel from an improvised explosive device concealed at the side of a road outside a small town in Afghanistan. The shrapnel appeared to be mostly small fragments of metal, probably offcuts from a village-style engineering shop. The 5 pieces that hit her peeled her face off in chunks. And what stayed on was then badly abraded by smaller particles in the blast. But these days, battlefield medicine is a miracle. They found most of the missing parts in her helmet, and they sewed her back together again. Big name, plastic surgeons, the whole 9 yards.
But,"
Reacher said, "2 main problems," Grandma said. "I mean, okay, this was amazing work, no question. This is a definite KIA in Vietnam, and probably any other time in history until the last few years. It was a virtuoso performance by the doctors, but great as it was actually pretty lousy. It just can't be done. She was left with scars like a jigsaw puzzle. Nothing fits right, nothing works right. She looks like a horror movie. And that's the good news."
"What's the bad news?"
"The concealed explosive device was concealed in a dead dog. That's something they do out there. This one was maybe 4 days old, getting ripe. The weather was hot. The blast drove rotting tissue and necrotic pathogens and all kinds of bad bacteria deep under the skin of her head. This all was 4 years ago, and she still can't get rid of the infection. She leaks pus. She looks like a monster twice over. She's in pain all the time.
Richard was quiet a long moment. Then he said,
"No wonder she didn't tell her sister. It's a subject they plan to discuss.
Why did she stop calling 1.5 years ago?"
"They haven't gotten to that yet. But something to do with Porterfield, surely. What else could it be?"
Richard got out of the car again. He wanted the air. He walked back to the edge of the ravine and watched the distant view. It was like looking out through a narrow window. Behind him, the house was cradled by wooded hills. He wondered who it belonged to. He walked back to the crew cab truck. All the windows were down. The three guys inside were laying back, patient, saving energy. They knew it was all going to take as long as it took. Maybe a cowboy thing. The guy in the boots looked up. Reacher said,
"You told me you were being nice about it."
"I agree. You're being very nice about the whole thing. That should be placed in the record." The guy moved his head as if accepting the compliment. Reacher said,
"How did it start?"
"We needed a place to live. We stumbled on this compound. Rose had already claimed it. But she let us stay. She helped us settle in. We helped her with a couple of things. We got kind of protective, I guess. She doesn't like people to see her."
"How long ago was this?"
3 years. Rose was just out of the army. She was just moving in."
"Who owns this place?"
"Someone who hasn't cared to visit in 3 years, at least."
"You must have known Cy Porterfield."
"I guess we met him a bunch of times."
"What did you make of the story with the bear?"
"I guess we thought it was what anyone would do."
"What did Porterfield do for a living?"
"We never inquired. All we knew is he seemed to make her happy.
She's high as a kite right now."
"Do you blame her?"
"Not one little bit. But I worry about her supplies holding up."
"We can't discuss that with you. We don't know who you are."
"I'm with her sister."
"Not really. The other guy is the detective she hired. No one understands who you are."
"I'm not a cop," Reacher said. "That's all that matters. I don't care about that stuff. But she could have a problem now Billy is gone. That's all I'm thinking."
"You know who Billy was?"
"Snowplow driver. Especially good in powdery conditions."
"You were a cop back in the day."
"Everyone was something back in the day. I'm sure you can walk past a cow without feeling the need to drive it to the railhead." "Billy ain't coming back. I hope Rose will be okay, that's all I'm saying." The guy said,
"They already got a replacement for Billy. He was by here this morning. His name is Stackley. Seemed like a nice enough guy. Reminded me of a cousin I got in insurance. So, all is right with the world again. It's back to business as usual."
Reacher said, "What is she buying?"
"Oxy and fentanyl patches."
"We talked to a guy who said that's a thing of the past."
"It's getting expensive."
"He said it should be getting impossible." "Where is it coming from?"
"It's the regular stuff. Same as always. In the white boxes with the brand names. Made in America. Right out the factory door. You get to where you can tell the difference."
"You guys like it, too?"
"A little bit, now and then. To take the edge off, time to time."
"I heard that kind of thing was hard to get now. Maybe I was misinformed."
"You weren't," the guy said. "Matter of fact, it is hard to get now. Most places, very hard. But not here. which gives you all a big problem. I don't know what your plans are now, but you need to get one thing straight from the get-go. Rose won't move from here. Not an inch. Not in a million years. How could she? She's hooked up here. You don't know what that means to a person. Look at it from her point of view. Chapter 34. The magic hour was the last part of the sun's daily travel, like a 60-minute farewell performance when it was low in the sky, shining sideways through the atmosphere, which reddened its colors and lengthened its shadows. Risha sat on the porch step and watched the tawny plain go gold, then ochre, then chili pepper red. Bramall was below him, on a rock at the edge of the ravine. The guys from the crew cab were sitting in the dirt, leaning their backs on trees. The door opened and Mackenzie stepped out. Reacher stood up, and she came down the steps past him onto the path through the scrub. Meanwhile, the guys from the crew cab all got up and dusted themselves off. Mackenzie met them at the end of the path. She shook their hands one by one and thanked them for caring about her sister. Then she said to Bramall,
"Back to the hotel."
Mackenzie felt weird, she said, leaving her sister where she was, but Rose would have it no other way. She liked it there, she said, and she had everything she needed. She refused to leave, categorically, even for one night, even to see a doctor. She refused even to consider going to the hospital or the Veterans Administration or looking at a clinic or a rehab center or living in Lake Forest, Illinois.
"Give her time," Bramall said.
They made the turn at the old Mule Crossing post office and drove back to Laramie on the two-lane. They ate in town and drove back out to the hotel, where Bramall parked and said good night. Reacher stayed out in the lot again. The night sky was still there, still huge and black and dusted with millions of bright stars. Microscopically changed, he supposed, since the night before, but not because of his tiny dramas. It was completely indifferent. Mackenzie came out and sat down on the bench. He sat down beside her. She said,
"She's only halfway addicted."
He said, "I had a brother. Not a twin, but we were close growing up. Now I'm asking myself, if this was him, what would I want from people? Something polite or something uncomfortable? I'm not making a point here. I really don't know. Help me out."
"I want the truth," she said.
She looked a lot more than halfway addicted to me.
"I meant her reasons. She's in pain. Partly she needs it. She's not doing it just for fun."
"What's with the aluminum foil?"
"The infection. She scrounges up antibiotics if she can, and grinds them down and mixes them with antiseptic salve from the first aid aisle. She spreads it on the foil like butter. If she can spare one, she mixes in an oxycodone pill."
"Not the life she expected."
"You knew last night, when you asked how we felt about being pretty."
"It was the only thing that fit."
"She's doing okay, I think."
"Me too."
"I even liked the house, in a way. I was surprised. For some reason, I thought it would be dark inside."
"Me too," he said again.
"Now tell me what happens next."
"I wish I knew."
"Seriously," she said, "I need to figure out how to handle this."
"She's doing okay because she gets high every day. You could give her money, I suppose, and most likely she would continue to do okay, as long as this new guy Stackley keeps on showing up on time, and as long as the boy detective doesn't plug the last leak and put everyone out of business."
which could happen.
Nothing lasts forever, Reacher said. Her situation out there is not as secure as she thinks it is.
Even if it was, I couldn't leave her there.
How are you going to move her out?
That's what I'm asking. I'm open to ideas.
Reacher said, is she getting no treatment at all?
At the beginning, she was in the hospital a whole year. She ran out of patience. She hasn't seen anyone since. She won't. She refuses to.
Instead, she lives quietly and self-medicates. She does it well enough. We both just agreed she's doing okay. We should respect that. The only way to get her out of there is promise her the exact same thing someplace else. Or even better, as many pills and patches as she wants. He would have to find the right kind of doctor. He would have to find her a quiet place to live. He would have to promise her no hassle, and he would have to mean it. Nothing, for a year at least. Which is okay. This kind of thing is a very long game.
She doesn't like people to see her.
And she's better off here than Illinois.
They don't have the right kind of doctors here.
How big is your yard?
I think 6 acres.
You could build her a cabin. With a high fence, you could throw her prescriptions over, leave her alone for a year, see what happens.
So, the only way to help her is to be a better pusher.
The boy detective said we shouldn't underestimate the appeal of an opiate high. I'm sure she's real pleased to see you, but you should assume getting what she needs right now feels more important to her.
That's tough to accept. Not about me, that she's so far gone.
She needs you on her side right now, proving that is your job one. Don't disapprove of her. What choice does she have? Just bite your lip and shovel pills down her throat. Don't forget, she's tough underneath. She's a combat veteran. Sooner or later, she'll realize she needs to shape up or ship out, and then she'll want to talk. To you, especially, because you were the one who treated her right. That's when you can help her.
I hope I can.
There are books about it. You can spend the first year reading.
Did you take classes?
Not enough curriculum time, Reacher said. In the MPs, it was all rubber hoses and nightsticks. But the medics had good people. Psychiatrists in uniform. The weirdest thing you ever saw, always some inflated rank. I knew a couple. They would tell you a bunch of things.
Like what?
They would tell you to figure out what's upsetting her deep down.
That's obvious, surely.
But they're shrinks, and they're in the army. They would say a person can have 2 things wrong at once. They would say they know what infantry officers are like. They would want more detail on the incident with the roadside bomb.
Why?
Specifically, they would want to know if there were other American casualties. If so, they would assume Rose is taking it hard. She was an infantry officer. She got her people killed. The facts don't count. She could have been already wounded and unconscious before anything else even happened. Doesn't matter. They're her people. It's her fault. That's how infantry officers think. Small words, but they mean a lot to those guys. The top boy at West Point said she led her soldiers well. That's the Hall of Fame right there. You could put that on your tombstone. She led her soldiers well. An infantry officer couldn't hear finer words than those. Because it's hard to do. Ultimately, it works because you make an unspoken promise not to get them killed. It becomes a thing in your head. Mackenzie said,
she won't talk about it.
Reacher said, the shrinks would also want to know the status of the mission. Was it a routine kind of thing ordered from above? Or was there an element of initiative involved? In which case, they would assume she was taking it even harder. She led her soldiers into harm's way. Literally.
They're shrinks. You said so yourself. They overcomplicate things. If you hear hoofbeats, you look for horses, not zebras. Rose is upset deep down because someone stuck her face in a blender and smeared it with dog shit.
Reacher said nothing. Mackenzie said, "What?"
"I'm sure that's most of it. How could it not be?"
"But?"
"I think like a cop. I can't help it. Her final rank was major. The guy at West Point told me on her last tour she was doing a pretty big job, which for a major means desk time and briefings. She had limited opportunities to get out and about. Why would she choose to go look at the side of a road outside a small town? She wouldn't. She was bored with that kind of stuff 4 tours ago. She went because her command presence was required. She had some kind of operation running. She had captains below her and lieutenants below them, all covering their own ass. So we can be certain the protective detail around her was thick on the ground. We can be certain lots of people were involved. Was she the only one hurt? Unlikely, but we don't know for sure. The files are sealed. Which means most likely her operation was a failure. Perhaps with multiple U.S. casualties. So her face may not be all of it. Mackenzie said,
"I don't know if you're trying to cheer me up or bring me down."
"It's all bad," Reacher said, "whichever way around. Let's not be Pollyanna." "But she had a boyfriend, Cy Porterfield. There were 2 dents in the bed. That says something about how she sees herself. It's a glimmer of what might be possible."
"She won't talk about him. I told her about the comb you found, and she didn't deny it. She said it was safer. I didn't know.
Whatever that means." "She thought I was an investigator come to ask questions about him."
"No one believes the bear story."
"Which could be an additional traumatizing factor. She really doesn't know what happened to her boyfriend. She really isn't sure which would be worse, the bear or not. The shrinks would throw a party. They would tell you it's a whole big mixture of things."
"In other words, it could be worse than just her face."
"That would be a glass-half-empty type of interpretation. But it's why I asked if you wanted polite or uncomfortable."
"I said truth. You're speculating."
"Agreed," Reacher said. "And I sincerely hope I'm wrong about all of it."
She was quiet a beat. Then she said,
"You're a kind man."
"Not a word that gets used often."
"Thank you for being here."
"My pleasure," he said. And it was.
It was a concrete bench in a blacktop lot, but a yard above the ground it was spectacular. The stars were better than he had ever seen. The air was cool and soft and hummed with silence. Beside him on the bench was a woman who looked like the back of a shiny magazine. He figured she would feel firm and lithe and cool to the touch, except maybe the small of her back, which might be damp. She asked him,
"Do you remember what I said about my husband?"
"You said he's a nice man. And you're a good match."
"You have a very precise memory."
"It was yesterday."
"I should have told you he keeps a mistress and ignores me."
Reacher smiled. He said,
"Good night, Mrs. Mackenzie."
She left him there the same as the night before, alone in the dark on the concrete bench, looking at the stars. At that moment, a mile away, Stackley clicked off a phone call and parked his beat-up old pickup truck in a lot
behind an out-of-business retail enterprise 3 blocks from the center of town. Earlier in his life, he had favored expensive haircuts, and one time, when waiting in the salon, he had read a magazine that said success in business depended entirely on ruthless control of costs. Thus, wherever possible, he slept in his truck, hence the camper shell. A motel would take what he made on 2 pills. Why give it away? The old gal across the snowy range had bought a box of fentanyl patches, but he had given her one he had already opened an hour before, very carefully, so he could skim out a patch all his own for his pocket for later. The old gal would never notice. If she did, she would assume she was too stoned to count right. A natural reaction. Addicts learn to blame themselves, the same the world over. He took scissors from his glove box, and he cut a quarter-inch strip off the patch, and he slipped it under his tongue. Sublingual, it was called. Another magazine in the same salon said it was the best method of all. Stackley couldn't argue. At that moment, 60 miles away in the low hills west of town, Rose Sanderson was putting herself to bed. She had pulled down her hood and taken off her silver tracksuit top. Under it was a T-shirt, which she took off, and a bra, likewise. She peeled the foil off her face. She used her toothbrush handle to scrape excess ointment off her skin. She buttered it back on the foil. With luck, she might get one more day out of it. She ran her sink full of cool water. She took a breath and held her face under the surface. Her record was 4 minutes. She came up and shook her head. Her hair had grown back in. She had cut it the week before West Point. She had to get a hat on. There were regulations. She had kept it short for 13 years. Now it was back, with coarse threads of gray, like barbed wire in a hay bale. The least of her problems. She took scissors from her cabinet, and she cut a quarter-inch strip off her patch, and she stuck it behind her bottom lip. A maintenance dose. It would keep her asleep all night. It would keep her warm and gentle and relaxed and at peace and cradled and happy. At that moment, 300 miles away in Rapid City, South Dakota, Gloria Nakamura was sitting in her car watching Arthur Scorpio's back door. Once again, it was showing a rim of light. It was propped open an inch, another warm night. He had been in there more than 2 hours. She had been working on her list of what might make a room hot enough for extra ventilation. Electronic equipment, maybe. She knew a guy with a home cinema. He had a closet full of black boxes that gave out a penetrating kind of heat. It was thin and fierce, and smelled faintly of grease and silicon. The guy had a fan in there, whirring all the time. Her cell phone rang. Her friend in computer crimes, who said, "Give me a yes or no answer. Do we assume it was Scorpio who got the text message about the new Billy?" She said, "We couldn't take it to court." That wasn't a yes or no answer. "Yes, we can assume it was Scorpio." The same signal just got a voicemail from a tower in Laramie, Wyoming, from someone by the name of Stackley. He called Scorpio Mr. Scorpio. He said all was well, but there were stories about 2 men and a woman poking around asking questions. One of the men was a very big guy, and they were in a black Toyota. Reacher, she thought. Her friend said, "Then Scorpio called back and left a voicemail in return. He told this guy, Stackley, the same thing he told Billy. He wants the big guy out of the picture. He was ordering a homicide again." "Wait," Nakamura said. Scorpio's door was opening. He stepped out to the alley and turned back and locked up. Then he headed for his car.
I'm going to follow him, she said.
Waste of gas, her friend said. She clicked off and started her motor. Scorpio went home. He went home every time. At that moment, 600 miles away, in a small town named Sullivan in the Oklahoma Panhandle, Billy ran a red light. He was in a $600 Ford Ranger pickup truck, more than 20 years old. He was out to get a second six-pack. He was mildly buzzed from the first. His pal from Montana was back at the motel waiting in the room. The next day, in the afternoon, they were due to meet a guy who had connections in Amarillo, Texas. The employment situation was looking good. The light he ran had a cop parked on it. The guy lit up his roof bar and yelped his siren once. Billy froze and kept on rolling. Dumb. He had nothing to hide. The buzz, maybe, but hey, this was a panhandle. A couple of beers was probably a minimum requirement to get behind the wheel. Apart from that, he was respectable. He couldn't run anyway, not in a $600 piece of shit. He hit the brake and pulled in at the curb. Like all humans, the cop was prey to small subliminal emotions. Billy's failure to stop right away kind of pissed him off. He found it cocky and disrespectful. Normally, he might just have pulled alongside and dropped his far window and told the guy to take it easy. But now he felt a hot bite of annoyance, and it kind of puffed him up and set his jaw, and he found himself launching into the whole big performance. He pulled up behind the pickup and left his lights flashing. He put on his hat. He counted to 20 and got out of the car. He unlatched his holster and put his hand on his gun. He walked forward slowly and stopped level with the old Ford's load bed, and he called out loud and clear,
"Sir, please step out of the vehicle."
The door opened. Billy got out.
"I'm sorry, sir," he said. "I guess I was daydreaming. I guess it was a good thing no one else was around."
The cop was pretty sure the air coming off the guy smelled like beer. He said, "License?" Billy dug in his pocket and handed it over. The cop said,
"Sir, please wait there."
He walked back to his car as slowly as he could. He got in. He had a computer terminal on a swan neck bolted to the tunnel near the shifter, courtesy of the last new mayor. All kinds of budget promises. He typed in Billy's details. Up came a code from the Western Division of the Federal DEA. He got out of the car again. He walked back to Billy as slowly as he could. And when he got there, he spun him around and banged his head on the old Ford's roof and cuffed his hands behind his back. Chapter 35. They met in the lobby at 8 in the morning. After the diner, they drove to the grocery store where they bought stuff for Rose. Food, mostly. Some of it wholesome, some of it not. But also soap, and a pair of pink socks, and a new comb with wide-spaced teeth, and a paperback book. The kind of little thing that got left out when a household budget came under pressure. They bought 2 of every type of antiseptic cream. Bramall's phone rang in the checkout line. He looked at the screen and said,
"It's Special Agent Novel from the DEA."
He answered and listened and made appreciative but noncommittal noises. At one point, he left a split-second gap as if he should be saying something but wasn't, as if he was choosing not to. One federal guy playing chess with another. Reacher knew the signs. Bramall clicked off and said,
"Billy was arrested last night in a small town in Oklahoma. Noble questioned him by phone. So far he's denying everything, including he claims he doesn't know anyone named Rose Sanderson or where she's located."
yesterday's news, Mackenzie said. We don't need Billy anymore.
The drive back to Rose's place was a typical Wyoming time